Well, good morning, friends, neighbors, countrymen, citizens, non-citizens. This is Lenny Lawson, the car guru, and I'm glad to be with you this morning. As usual, flying solo today. The reasons for that are that I can't get away from this place, this car dealership of mine. We've been quite busy trying to finish August in a strong way, and we did. Really good month. You know, it's weird how you can start the month and you thinking, okay, this is going to be the first bad month we've had in a while because you just don't have any inventory. And then it starts to roll in and, you know, you sell some cars and then you get a few more in and then you sell some more and you get more in. And it's just, you just feel like you're chasing your tail all the time. But we did get enough product in and turned it real quickly. And now we have no cars and wondering what the heck's going to happen in September. But we're supposed to get about 50 more Nissans in, and no idea about Ford. We still have some decent selection of F-150s. Been getting a lot of the hybrids in. If you're interested in just seeing what a really cool vehicle drives like, get down here to Greenville. It's on the map. We're pretty much smack dab in the middle between Johnson City and Morristown, if you're not familiar with this area. If you are, you already know where we are. And the it's easy to get here, and we've got like, I think, five hybrids F-150s in stock, which means it has a 3.5 EcoBoost twin turbocharged engine. That's what EcoBoost means, folks. If you always wondered what that is, it means turbocharged. And typically, they'll have two. Sometimes they just have one. I remember when turbocharger went bad, it cost about $2,500 to just replace the turbo. But now, it doesn't cost near that much. They're much smaller, compact. They're very well engineered, and they last a long time. But when you do have to replace them, they're anywhere from $600 to $800. So that's a whole lot more tolerable. But anyway, the EcoBoost engine technology has been a resounding success for the Ford Motor Company. General Motors went a different route. They went with cylinder deactivation, meaning that if you had a V8 engine in a Silverado, that it would automatically drop a couple cylinders and run on six cylinders or four cylinders, depending on what the driver of the vehicle was requiring by his action on the gas pedal. And so, you know, that has worked pretty well too, but I think the Ford model with smaller displacement engines with turbos has worked very well. Also, you know, the aluminum thing. Remember when GM used to make, in their commercials, make so much fun of Ford F-150 with the aluminum body, and they'd drop cinder blocks in the bed and toolboxes and things like that. See, it's just not durable. Well, that didn't work. You know, it is durable. It does good. It makes the vehicle much lighter weight. Everybody has their own thing. Ram has really done a number on the Silverado sales. And the GMC Sierra. Ram has been very successful in courting younger drivers. You notice. You just look around. See who drives a Ram truck. It's typically somebody 40 or younger. That's their main demographic. But, you know, occasionally you have a geezer like me that will buy a real nice, one of their luxury trucks. They have beautiful interiors in their trucks. But it's just hard to beat the Ford F-150. Nobody's been able to in 44 years. So I couldn't even beat them when I was a Chevrolet dealer. So I'm like that guy that said, I got tired of competing against them, so I just bought the company. Well, I really did. That's not really how it happened. But anyway, there are so many different ways to skin a cat. You know, I've heard that saying for a lot of years. There's probably not a bunch of different ways to skin a cat, but there are a bunch of different ways to build trucks and cars, and everybody kind of has their own take on that. You know, I was looking at a new crossover that's getting ready to come out. Mazda is coming out with a new, I think it's called a CX-30, and they were talking about just how beautiful it is. Heck, they all look the same. You know, you think about a Honda CR-V versus a RAV4 versus a Ford Escape. You know, they all look basically the same. You go to a soccer game and look in the parking lot, and that's all there is now. there's no real personality to the parking lot anymore because everything looks very similar. You know, other than the grill, you know, they will have differences in the grill and the taillights. Interiors are different in some ways, but for the most part, you know, everybody's kind of going chasing after the same design theme, and it's getting kind of tiresome. I guess that's why I like the Bronco so much, because it broke the mold. It took us back in time, though, you know, back into the 60s. I was looking at the VIN number on just under the windshield on the driver's side of a new Bronco, and etched on the glass there it says, "Established 1966. That was the first time the Bronco actually hit the market. It is amazing, though, the differences in generations. If you talk to people my age, they will, and you say the word Bronco, they think about that Bronco that was the original one, you know, that was built from 66 to 77. If you mention Bronco to a millennial, they're thinking O.J. Simpson. They're thinking the F-150-based Bronco. And then when they see this Bronco, and they say, well, that's not what I thought it was going to look like. And, you know, I say, why not? You know, that's what the original Bronco looked like. No, it didn't. Yes, it did. No, it didn't. You know, so you get in this argument. But, you know, I like boxes. I didn't used to. I remember when Chevrolet was building the Malibu, and Ford had the Granada. Do you remember the Granada? We called them grenades as a Chevy dealer. I wouldn't dare do that now as a Ford dealer. But the Chevrolet was had more curves, and the Granada was very boxy. And I wasn't a fan of boxes then, but I like them now. I like square things. You know, one of the things I like about squares is that it creates more interior space, more practical room. It's not very aerodynamic, and I think that's one of the reasons why so many of the manufacturers were doing everything they could to make cars curvier because the air slipped around them better. But really, as efficient as engines have gotten now, that you know, it's just really not necessary. And you can build a box and still get really good gas mileage. So I don't know. We'll see how these design trends go. So here's what I'm going to do now. I'm going to take a break, and I'm going to talk about something we've talked about before, but it is a real issue, and that's salvage and wrecked vehicles that are being sold on the open market, and how you need to be careful, especially when hurricanes hit a large swath of our country, and those cars that are underwater now end up sometimes at auctions that people can buy those cars, and they can end up on the street and get resold, and you can buy one without even knowing it. So we're going to try to help you prevent that here in just a minute. Okay, we're back. You know, I don't know whether you know this or not, but junkyard business has changed. At one time, there were a lot more junkyards, and they had a lot more vehicles in the junkyard. And now, you know, you just don't see the big junkyard operations because vehicles are being crushed. And there's more money sometimes in crushing vehicles than in salvaging parts out of them. Now, I went to a body shop, or not a body shop, a salvage yard the other day that is more of the old school. And they probably have the very first car that they ever had is still in that lot somewhere. It's Jerry's Auto Salvage in Greenville. And I needed some seats for my Ford 1949 F4 car hauling project. And went out there, was successful finding some seats out of a wrecked 2014 Ford Mustang. And I think they're going to be quite comfortable and fit me well. Power seats on both sides, and I get them all covered in brand new leather and nice and in a nice color that will match the interior. So you can do pretty much what you want to, but you got to have a frame first, and you got to have a seat that's going to fit. And so there were junkyards that are in that kind of business, but most of those have gone away. And so just about anybody can go buy a salvage car now. I was looking at a website for a company called Copart, and they are the big salvage company. They buy cars from insurance companies, and then the insurance companies, or sometimes the insurance companies, just sell their cars through Copart. And just for flood-damaged cars, I was just searching for that, Guess how many cars are for sale through Copart right now, available on auction, that have been underwater, had a bad water experience? Approximately 6,635 vehicles. You know, here's a 2015 Volkswagen Jetta, 2007 Honda Accord, 2016 Nissan Murano, and the list goes on. 2009 BMW. You know, all these vehicles are going to be bought by somebody. You know, some of them have low miles. Here's one with 71,000 miles, 37,000 miles. Here's more that have like 100 and plus. But you look at some of the bids on these vehicles, and, you know, if you're registered with Copart, you can just go and buy these. And where do they end up? Well, sometimes they end up getting fixed. And more often than not, they end up getting fixed, and they end up in somebody's driveway. And that person may be an unsuspecting salvage car buyer. There are still ways to wash titles. That's what they call it, washing titles. That's where, instead of having salvage history stamped on the front of the title, it's a clean title, and you would never know it. And so you've got to be careful. The best way to avoid a flood-damaged car is just to have it inspected before you buy it. And I guess some people don't care if they're desperate for transportation. As long as they turn the key and it starts and goes where they need it to go, then they feel fine with it. But salvage cars, anything that's been underwater, it's going to have a lot of issues. It may not be apparent at the get-go. You know, sometimes they even pull the airbags out of these cars. You know, if the airbags have exploded, they just find a replacement steering wheel, mount it, and it doesn't have an airbag in it. You think you're buying a car with an airbag, and the airbag system doesn't even work. And then they take the bulbs out of the dash lights so that even if it did trigger a light on the dash, it won't come on because the bulb is missing. So there's all kinds of little things that these crooks do to get people to buy these vehicles. And it's, you know, it's profit motive. And it's the profit motive gone awry, as I like to say. There are some tips out there that I'd like to provide to you about avoiding a flood-damaged vehicle. And one of the most important things is just to trust your sense of smell. You know, if you open the door on a car and you smell that musty smell, moldy smell, you can feel dampness in the carpet sometimes if it's a fairly recent incident. Steer clear of that car. You know, once that smell is in there, it's really hard to get it out. You can even replace the seats or replace the carpet sometimes, and it won't come out because it's in the headliner. And so stay, unless, you know, you have no sense of smell, then I guess it's not a problem. But if you do, then that's going to be a problem going forward. You know, ask questions about an older car that you see that has brand new carpet in it. If it has a brand new interior, you know, the fabric, that could be a dead giveaway that this car has been underwater. Check for rust in places where it shouldn't be, like real high up in the engine compartment, or actually on the brake pedal, you know, on the back of the brake pedal or the gas pedal. You might see some rust. I've actually seen sand deposits up underneath the dash of a car. And that's how I discovered a car that had been underwater. So some of these things are not real obvious to the novice. And I think if you are a novice and you're out trying to buy a used car, then you need to take somebody with you that knows what they're talking about, that knows mechanics, that understands that they can actually drive a car and they can tell if the transmission's slipping. They know an engine miss when they feel it. They can tell if the steering has too much play in it. You know, these are all little clues that you get that there might be something wrong with the vehicle. I was talking to a lady the other day, and she had a really nice, I think it was a 1987 model vehicle. And she was going, and it was small. It was like a sports car. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want to give it away. But she was going to give this to her up-and-coming new driver. And I looked at her and I said, can I tell you my opinion about that? And she said, sure. And I said, I wouldn't do that. I said, if I'm going to give a 16-year-old a car in today's day and time, I want it to have airbags. I want it to have side impact, head curtain airbags. I want something relatively late model, you know, that's got the latest technology. It doesn't have to be a big car, but just something that has, you know, a lot of the modern safety devices on it. Why would you want to put a kid in a car, and a young driver, and put him in an old Mustang or an old Jeep? I mean, I know that's what they want, but you don't always have to give kids what they want, do you? I mean, I don't think so. I think they ought to be grateful just to get a car, to have some wheels. I mean, I see a lot of parents, and I spoiled my kids. I didn't give them new vehicles to drive. I did give them used vehicles to drive. So, you know, but it was always the late model. And probably within 90 days after my youngest child got her driver's license, I had given her a used Volkswagen Jetta to drive, and she wiped it out on the way coming home from school. And she went off the road and jerked the steering wheel, overcorrected, and put it into a spin, and it took out a fence row and a couple of trees, and she had no injuries because she had her seatbelt on and a full complement of airbags. There was only, when I looked at the car after it had been towed to the dealership, when I opened the door, and there was one little drop of blood on the airbag, and I lost it. I mean, when I saw that. And it's just an emotional experience when you see something like that. And, you know, she survived it. And I know that, you know, it's one of those things. Of course, we're very sensitive about that after losing our son in a car accident. And he was driving, I think it's a early 90s Honda Accord in his accident. And so, you know, it had airbags, but it wasn't, you know, the latest and greatest. And, you know, the circumstances were different. And I never did see that car. I couldn't look at it. I didn't want to see it. You can imagine. But it was, you know, you want to put your kid in something that is safe and, you know, the latest technology. And maybe, you know, some people say, well, I can't afford to buy a car like that. If you look hard enough, you can, even if you have to buy something with higher miles on it. Still, put them in something that's safe. If you're a grandparent and you're close enough to the situation of a family and an up-and-coming teenager and they're wanting to buy a Jeep CJ5 from the 70s and drive that to school and stuff, I just think that's a mistake. And, you know, make them prove themselves and prove their responsibility first in a vehicle and, you know, let them buy in. I was talking to a gentleman who bought an old Mustang for his son, and they restored the car when they bought it. They bought it a year before he got his license. And he said, if you and I working together can get this thing running, then you can drive us to school in the coming school year and after you get your driver's license. And, you know, there's a lot of value in that, just a father and a son or a father and a daughter working together to build a car so that they can go on. And you know, I guess you have to weigh those the value of those decisions, whether – you know, the value of doing something with dad and mom to get a car to, you know, to where it runs and performs and they get to use that versus just, you know, getting them something safe. I can see both sides of the argument, but I'm gonna err on the side of safety all the time if anybody ever asks me. Well, we'll take our last break and we'll be back in just a minute. Okay, I'm back. You know, a lot of people rely on Carfax. Or AutoCheck is another one that's provided by a company called Experian. The reality is that a lot of flood-damaged vehicles, salvaged vehicles, are never turned over to the insurance company. A lot of wrecked vehicles, people say, well, I don't want to increase my insurance rates, and if I turn this in, then, you know, it's going to have a negative impact on my rates. And that's, there's truth in that, but... So don't rely on a Carfax as the sole source of information to determine whether you should buy a used car or not. Take it to somebody who knows cars. Take it to a shop. You know, pay them. Is it worth paying somebody a couple hundred dollars to really do a thorough inspection on a used car before you buy it, just to make sure you don't make a mistake? I mean, I think that's a no-brainer. But there's too many people that don't. You know, they jump in a car, they drive it down the street, and they say, well, this drives good. you know, and they rely on the owner. And, you know, some people think car dealers are crooks. I mean, there's a lot of customers out there. There's a lot of car owners out there that will not level with you. I think the safest place to buy a used car, I've said this many times, is at a new car dealership, because they have so many different ways that you can hurt them, you know, if you're not happy. You know, it's from Google ratings to, you know, just complaints with the factory. There's so much more legal liability for new car dealers than just, you know, the guy that's selling cars off out of his front yard and or an individual. You just have more recourse against a dealer, and I just think that it's a safer place to buy a used car. Now, others may disagree, and of course you're entitled to. I've just been doing this for 43 years, and my experience is fairly broad. So anyway, buy a vehicle for your youngster that's safe. Watch out for flood-damaged cars. Ask the right questions. Get somebody to inspect it that can really help you make a good decision. And that's it. That's all I have to say today. And we will see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.